That's the Dirty Dozen Brass Band from New Orleans with John the Revelator. That comes from their album of 2004, Funeral for a Friend. The whole album is dedicated to funeral music. And this may sound a little morbid, but it isn't, actually, pardon that pun. It's quite uplifting. The album is very uplifting. And the tradition is, on the way to the cemetery, they do a little bit of sad-sounding music, but even so, it's got lilt to it, it's got a rhythm and beat to it. And then on the way back from the cemetery, it's all joyful. And the person is celebrated, and that their soul has flown away, but they went well. And that was John the Revelator. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And it's Free Your Mind Friday. This is your time to talk about issues that you think are important. They may or may not have been in the headlines, and you are free to talk about whatever you think you'd like to put out there for people to consider. And so we entertain your calls at 888-874-4888. But try and be as concise as you possibly can so that we can get as many calls in as possible. First up is from Los Angeles. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Eutrice.
Hello, Harvey. Wonderful Harvey. What have you to say today?
Oh, well, first of all, I live in Berkeley. Sorry you got that.
Yes. Okay, sorry.
Okay, the key to our clean energy transportation future is something called electric hub brushless motors. You can Google that, electric hub, H-U-B, brushless, B-R-U-S-H-L-E-S-S, motors. And what it is that they build the motor into the wheel. And so you don't need a big engine, you don't need a drivetrain anymore. And they're found on bicycles now. You can see them a lot on bicycles, electric bicycles, but they can go on cars, buses, trucks, skateboards, trains, subways. And the beautiful thing about electric hub motors is that when you step on the brakes, you get something called regenerative braking, which means that it turns from a motor into a generator, and the electrons are fed back into the battery to recharge the battery. And so the thing is that these new kinds of electric hub motors, because they you don't have to have all the equipment, you can redesign cars. You can open up the design of cars and be very, very creative. They're also very easy for maintenance, and electric hub motors are very fast and powerful. So they're great. And you can plug, of course, plug your electric hub motor car into your solar electric rooftop, and it'll run on solar electrons. So that's the key to our clean energy future, electric hub brushless motors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patrice.
You always give us a reason to be hopeful about changing the way we think about things, because we've become so accustomed to thinking that there's only one way to go. But you always give us some room for re-examining the standard ways of thinking, and it's really refreshing. Thank you so much, Harvey, for your call today.
Thank you, Eutrice.
Thank you. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Great to see you, Eutrice.
Thank you, and same to you.
Oh, yes, Eutrice, and greetings, of course, to the PRN audience. Is something going on in the background? Because I was listening to the call from Harvey, and it sounded kind of warped. I don't know. Well, maybe it might be on his end, but it sounds clear on my end. Is everything coming in clear on your end?
Fine, except it's are you on speaker?
No, ma'am, I'm not on speaker.
Okay.
Is it any clear? Is it better now?
You're fine. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll adjust the volume. I had on a headset.
Okay.
Yes, Eutrice. What I was going to talk on to free my mind is the situation in regards to what's going on with this Ebola. And from what I am seeing, Eutrice, it's the same situation being at play once again. Because every time I've turned on and I looked at different various news sources as well as read various news sources, and it's the same thing at play. It's the usual people are the subject matter experts, and black people are the fatalistic victims, hapless victims who can't help themselves, who can't seem to do nothing to help themselves. All of the epidemiologists, the virologists, you know, the various tropical diseases experts, they're all white, they're all European. And black people who are on the continent and supposedly lived with this bacteria virus for centuries as a part of the ecosystem, they're not consulted. They're not being asked for input because they are supposed to be the victims. They're supposed to be the victims that are in need of the European help, and therefore they need to play the role of victims. And this is something that really and truly gets on my nerve, Utrecht, because I know that there are a lot of skilled virologists, bacteriologists. You look at the Cuban delegation, for instance, who they don't want to give any sort of credit to, who have went down there to render assistance, and they've always done that. And they've been in Haiti and various Caribbean countries giving of themselves without expecting anything in return. And we know that they've been on the continent even before this so-called outbreak happened again. But you don't see them on the news. You don't see them being given anything. And these are the experts in this part of the Western Hemisphere. They want us to think that the CDC and the NIH and the World Health Organization, that these people are supposed to be these experts, but in reality, they are not. Because these people are being sponsored by private companies, philanthropists, to be specific, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as these other people out here who fund the World Health Organization.
Well, you have a very strong point. And this is part of what we talk about here all the time, that the knowledge of anything seems never to be a democratic process. Knowledge,
exactly.
Knowledge is always retained by one group, and the people who are in a position really to be experts. Expertise is just not relegated to people of color. It just doesn't happen that way. The thing that is frightening too, Sarah, is you look at the Obama administration's response. It is outrageous, to say the least. Now they've appointed this new guy. His name is Klain is his name. They've appointed him to be the Ebola czar, Ron Klain. He's to oversee the handling of the crisis. Now, who is this? I talked before about the fact that the Secretary of Health has absolutely no medical experience whatsoever. None. No credentials in the field of medicine. But Obama finds that she is absolutely qualified for this job, which is why there is no response articulated. These are people undergoing on-the-job training.
Training.
Okay? So the Secretary of Health has no health qualifications whatsoever. She comes out of the Office of Management and Budget. The newly appointed Ebola czar has absolutely no medical experience whatsoever either. And where does he come out of? He was Joe Biden's chief of staff, and he was Al Gore's chief of staff. And that qualifies him to coordinate a national program, a national response on a health crisis. This is an amazing thing. And the point I'm making here is, even at this point, the president should have some inkling that he needs to get the very best people there are to really hunker down and come up with a comprehensive plan. You have the health secretary who is completely clueless about how you deal with a medical crisis, and you have the guy who is overseeing the medical crisis having no clue whatsoever. But I want you to listen to this because this plays to your point. The media described him, I wrote this paragraph down today. Klain is not known for his healthcare expertise. What does that mean to you, Sarah?
It means to say he's a novice.
He knows nothing. That's what exactly. That means to say. But that's how they phrased it. Klain is not known for his healthcare expertise, though he will be getting briefings on these policies. He will be getting briefings on these policies in his capacity, as a campaign strategist for Gore and the Democrats.
You see, I just have to say this,
Sarah, before I burst.
Yes, ma'am.
The media is reporting that a campaign manager is good enough in the eyes of Barack Obama, the president, who has a crisis on his hands. And this isn't the first one. This is in addition to the enterovirus, which is killing off little children. But the president selects a campaign manager to be the Ebola czar. And this makes sense to this president at this time with this kind of a crisis, an incipient crisis on our hands. And so we have, when you put the Secretary of Health, who has no experience whatsoever, completely unqualified for her job, and you put this new guy who is completely unqualified for his job, and you know the reason he was chosen? Because he briefed Barack Obama. He's a lawyer. Now, he's a lawyer by training. He briefed Barack Obama during Barack Obama's debate with John McCain. And ta-da, he is qualified. Yes, indeed. And you wonder why people are having problems with this president?
You see, Yatrice, what this is showing you, this presidency is going to go down as being the most inept group of people, because I really truly don't believe he has any hand in who is being selected. He's going to be the fall guy. The face is going to be used because the buck stops with him. But he has absolutely no input, because it's like you, Yatrice, it's like me going to a dentist for a heart problem. They're both supposed to be medically trained, but their specialty is totally different. Why would I go and let a dentist operate on me because or use him as my oncologist, and he has no training in cancer? But that is but that is how this administration is running it. They are running it slapstick, because yes, you said there is no surgeon general, there is no specialty. Here it is that you see the best person that they had on the African continent, who the Nigerian doctor, who they did not treat. They allowed this man to die, over the year. Yeah, they let us, and he was the best expert they have on there. He didn't get the ZMAP. He didn't get any of their experimentation. He allowed to die. So it shows me, you treat, and people want to say, and I'm going to say this and let you, please, a friend of mine just texted you and said, please, if you could get Harriet Washington.
Oh, we'll be addressing it. We'll be addressing it.
Get her on, because people like to say that we crazy and we like to see race. Everything is about race in this country.
But it is the ineptness. This president is so the ineptness of this president, and it's so deliberate. It's an amazing thing to see this happening, and this is how the media who would normally question anybody who would do such a stupid thing as appoint a Secretary of Health with no experience. You appoint a Secretary of Education who needs an education. You appoint the Ebola czar who has great experience as he ran a campaign. Whoop-de-doo. That really qualifies for him to run an Ebola preventive plan. This makes sense to this president. And this is so offensive on so many levels. People ought to be in the streets about it. Thanks for your call, Sarah, today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Yatrice.
And have a good weekend. Maat, you on the air from Brooklyn, New York.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon.
Thank you.
With Yatrice and to the PR and family.
Thank you.
I have some thoughts on Ebola. And one thought is, and really might be pertinent, you can't expect the entity and the state that caused the problem to come to and to correct and cure the problem. I want to reference Obama using the word putting together a squat team. I mean, when you think about squat team, you think about something that's militarized. And, of course, one of the more recent incidents in about 80,000 a year now of knocking down the wrong door, killing a lot of innocent people, and that includes the people that might even have the drugs because you're supposed to be innocent. And more recently, a grenade that destroyed a young baby's face. But I also want to reference some very excellent reportage in the final call. Last week, and I would suggest if you can't get a hard copy, I'm sure it's online. Last week, they had an article headline, Ebola is not a natural disease. Now, back in the 90s, what conforms with that, when there used to be these African scholarly journals that you used to be able to get in good magazine stores in Manhattan, and they talked about the Marburg virus, where in the 1930s in Nazi Germany, it was created as a bioweapon. And they also reference a lot of information in that article and the current one in the Final Call, the final, I guess it's finalcall.com, is they reference one of their doctors who's, I guess, their Minister for Health and Human Services, Dr. Mohammed, and his thoughts on this unnatural disease. And by the way, the CDC has patents on these Ebola strains. And let me also reference that there's something very peculiar about this being a hemorrhagic virus, because CNN or one of those cable news stations had a Dr. Adam Levine, who just returned from Liberia, helping patients there. And he said that only 18% of the people are actually having bleeding. So there's a piece of the puzzle missing there, and that's confirmed by people who've actually noticed that the bleeding that is usually expected is not really the problem that it had previously been or thought of in terms of a hemorrhagic fever.
Well, you know, the situation with Ebola, and I've done as much reading as I possibly can do, and I still am, just to get myself grounded in it. It appears that there are so many different interpretations of what's going on, and the science of it still is not absolutely firm. It is still an issue in progress in terms of research. But, I mean, they have some good ideas of what's going on, but there's still much more to do in a way of research. I've read a lot, and I've seen from the absolute bizarre in terms of interpretation to middle of the road to radical. So there are all kinds of interpretations about what this disease is. We'll soon be talking about this, but I wanted first to familiarize myself with all of the strains of thought on this particular disease.
Well, definitely see the Final Call pieces.
I will take a look at those.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
And lastly, I want to share with you that a case of police sheriff brutality, and this can be looked at through the Colorado Independent and Susan Green's work, but a gentleman, a homeless preacher, who had very extensive and renowned ties to the faith community over many generations and also knew and was tied to Martin Luther King, was brutally, and there's some video of it, was brutally beaten when he went to get his shoes after he was in a booking area of the police station in Denver. And he was just, 135 frail man, was compressed by, five different sheriff's deputies and officers. And then they, one person walked away and they came back with a taser and tasered him after he was completely immobilized and not moving. They threw him in a cell, didn't think to check about him. And there's a very interesting case I'd like to hear you talk about and maybe get some guests on, because the taser disappeared, the video disappeared, a black mayor, didn't speak up, and during the trial, they tried to reverse it and that he was a worthless person. So his name is Marvin Lewis Booker. He had a horrendous death, and I look forward to hear you your thoughts on that as you get the information.
All right. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
From New York also, Joel, you're on the air.
Hi, Yatrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Yatrice, a couple of days ago you had a very interesting program, and it's continued today with the discussion that you just had with Sarah and with others, about these blithering idiots that populate this administration, utterly unqualified. And while I, of course, completely agree with that, it struck me that we also face the opposite problem. We have people who are eminently, and in the past who have been eminently qualified to direct American policy both at home and abroad, but who have really created disasters. For instance, I think of the Vietnam War, and I remember a very famous book written by the journalist David Halberstam called The Best and the Brightest. Do you remember that book?
I don't recall it, no.
Well, but, you know, the phrase became part of the American lexicon because all those people that were associated in the planning and the realization of American policy in Indochina were people with incredible pedigrees. For instance, you have the Bundy brothers, William Bundy and McGeorge Bundy, who came right out of Harvard. You had Walt Whitman Rostow, who was the eminent economic historian from MIT, who was really the eminence grey, the gray eminence of the Kennedy and the Johnson administrations. Later on, you had Henry Kissinger, who was a walking resume of the diplomat. Most of these people came out of what used to be called the American establishment. They went to the best schools, then went to Ivy League colleges, then had law school educations or business school educations at Ivy graduate schools, and then joined elite international law firms or international corporations and moved fluidly back and forth between the State Department and Defense Department. Somebody like Jean Kirkpatrick, as you mentioned earlier, is another example. She was, associated with Georgetown University, which is intimately connected with the foreign policy establishment. And you might remember that she's responsible for a piece that she wrote when she became UN ambassador, in which she distinguished between benign dictatorships and metastasized dictatorships, thereby providing the rationale for American horror shows in Guatemala, in Nicaragua, in Honduras, and in El Salvador. So not only, unfortunately, are we faced with a bunch of blithering idiots who don't know what they're doing and just simply make matters worse, but we've also in our history had people in government who meet all the standards of professionalism but have given us nothing but disasters.
No question about it. The question now, though, is we're faced with a crisis that requires specialty treatment, right? Would you disagree?
Absolutely.
And so one would expect that the people appointed to be in the vanguard of this particular crisis and handling it, that they would bring to this crisis the relevant expertise and experience. But when you're telling the people that you think a lawyer, and the nation is just filled with lawyers, a lawyer who has no medical experience, who has never coordinated a mass campaign in terms of health, public health is not a political campaign. I'm sorry, but it isn't. And that at this time, with the country facing a major potential crisis here, the best person you could think of is someone who requires on-the-job training. And that just blows my mind.
Sure, but me too. But Yatrice, I think that part of this is not only due to the ineptness of this administration, but I really think, perhaps I'm wrong, but I really think that Obama is using the Ebola epidemic as a pretext for sending ground troops into Africa. I mean, what are these Marines going to do?
In fact, that is exactly the point of view from Africa, and we'll be talking about that. The Africans are very concerned about that.
Yes, I mean, what is he going to do? Fight a virus, which suspiciously looks like a genocidal biological warfare weapon? Who's being demonized? Blacks and Africa. And this strikes a very familiar note with me. I mean, if you revisit the HIV, we revisit HIV, its African origin and the Haitian issue. HIV was such a big issue in Haiti that it seemed to be a national trait and reason to fear contact. My question is, why was it so big in Haiti and not the Dominican Republic? They share the same small island as Hispaniola. Did HIV refuse to cross the border? I'm not saying that there's no HIV in the Dominican Republic, but it is not associated with HIV/AIDS. Haiti was. Why? The answer requires a study of Haitian history, why its revolution frightened all white supremacist racist states, and why these banded together to ensure it would be eternally punished for daring to challenge and win their freedom. You know what I mean? After all, Haiti was the first army to defeat Napoleon, even though he wasn't on the field. What the white supremacists feared was that other black slaves, and Gerald Horn has mentioned this again and again, in the Americas would be inspired to do the same. Now, what has the so-called black president done in Haiti? With our consent, Obama has essentially ended Haitian independence with permanent occupation and manipulation of its policies with U.S. puppets. And to do this requires U.S. black consent in the form of a black president and other enablers like Al Sharpton and Michael Dyson. And so it seems to me, by the way, that the loss of Haiti's independence also paralyzes the disenfranchisement of Detroit. And it's this legacy of this black president, with the consent of many black politicians, that's allowing this to happen. And I don't think Bush, nor McCain, nor Romney could have accomplished this, and they know it. I think that's his great accomplishment. So what is going on in Africa, it seems to me, is something that is akin to ethnic cleansing and genocide.
Well, your view is very consistent with what I'm getting from many people in Africa. We'll be talking about this very shortly.
Good.
But, you know, it is a very disturbing thing on so many levels. But I just couldn't help today, you know, reading in the newspaper that the actual news reporters are actually already saying, never mind this, it may seem a little lopsided to you, so we are performing a propaganda service here and saying that he is not known for his healthcare expertise.
No.
I mean,
you know, and I don't want to sound like I'm being over the top again, because I really don't throw charges of genocide around carelessly. And as you say, I'm not the first one to suggest this. In fact, I remember when I was a kid, Paul Robeson hand-delivering such a charge to the UN against the USA 60 years ago. And it seems to me that genocide is what is happening there. To a certain extent, you've got incremental genocide in this country, in places like Ferguson. Ethnic cleansing is what's happening in Detroit, in Haiti. It's a distressing situation, because what we're seeing is a kind of cleansing and genocide of Africans and Arabs and Africa and the Middle East and the Americas, and it has much to do with a reinvigoration of white supremacy and imperialism, which supports a kind of manifest destiny of the white man's burden. It's distressing. It depresses me, to tell you the truth.
Thank you so much for your call today,
okay.
Joel. Always. Thank you. From
bye.
New Jersey, Louis, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to talk about just about what's going on, like basically everything about, like, you know, they appoint these guys to like certain college education that doesn't even apply to what they're being, like you were talking about the guy who's appointed right now.
Yes.
I think it all has to do with, like, the cause that, you know, college education is so expensive and it limits the potential of the average human being. So when I mentioned this, I mean, like, you know, I try to basically, you know, you try to study something, but once you get involved in politics, you know, you always need a political favor from somebody. And that basically limits the potential of what, you know, the original ideology of someone can be. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the U.S. who could maybe become great doctors and maybe handle the situation in a better manner. But because of the student loans and things like that,
tell me about it. Are you a college student, Lewis?
Yeah.
Tell me about your experience and what is your particular critique of the college experience?
I feel like, my parents are from South America, they're from Ecuador, and I feel like we are basically fed, like, a really bad elementary education, elementary school and high school. So by the time we get to college, it's really not, like, I feel like most students don't even know what they want to study. And, you know, once you're, like, 2 years into your major, you can't just change your major after that because,
right,
you know, you have student loans, especially, you know, like, families, you know, they have to find a way to, you know, help each other out. And you see, like, the point I'm trying to make is, like, they don't get to, you know, fulfill their potential, fulfill their destiny because, you know, these obstacles come in the way.
Is this what you think has happened? Is this what you think is happening in your case, your particular case, that you wanted to change your major, but you have had to basically stick with your initial decision? because of money, because of debt?
Yeah, I guess in a way, yes, because, you know, I've always been someone passionate about politics. And, you know, my parents, you know, they worked really hard to, like, give me a better future. And, you know, it seemed really bad for me, you know, like 2 years into my college studies, and just say, you know, I want to switch into this. So it, like, puts, you know, it's not something that's, like, you know, it doesn't really limit you, but I guess it, like, kind of, like, you look at your family and you basically see a situation there, and you're like, I can't really go in that route, you know, because I don't want to make sure my parents are the ones that, like, stuck with, like, a whole, you know, economic, like, they don't know what their son, they don't want the uncertainty of their son and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to also specify something about what's going on in Latin America. In Bolivia, Evo Morales, just won the election, and you don't hear anything about that in the media.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is, Luis?
Oh, it's clear because he's indigenous. He has an indigenous background. He's a union worker, and he was fighting for the people's rights. What they're trying to push in this U.S. government is just basically people who are willing to return political favors, and, you know, we never get anything actually done. So it's like you look at Ebola, you look at the economic crisis. It's like, and we're still working with political favors. That's what we're running on at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
you have a good assessment of it. So I'm going to ask you, what therefore is your choice now as you proceed with college? What are you going to be doing? Because you already said that you had an idea of doing something else other than the major that you're pursuing now. So how are you going to deal with that issue?
Well, what I plan on doing is I plan on just finishing my major and going from there, just trying to get a job and basically pay off some of my student loans and basically see if I can do this again, because, you know, it sucks when you realize that maybe you're limited to, like, the things you can study because of, you know, the financial, mm-hmm. you know, debt that you can take from a simple college education, when there's countries like Germany who are trying to, you know, abolish that, so, you know, people can reach their full potential and get the best of
You're making an extraordinarily strong point here, and that is one of the failures in the college education. I mean, I remembered when in my day, to register was a big circus. I mean, you had to fight to get into a class, and if by some means, you just couldn't register because the classes were filled, and you said, well, what is this? It's like a zoo. You're supposed to be able to, if you want to take such and such a class, you're supposed to be able to take that class. You're not supposed to be omitted from the process because your last name begins with an L and they stopped registration before the L's. All these silly things interfering with what you want to do with an education. But what you're pointing out is a really incredible story. How many people do you think are in the same situation as you? They started out thinking, well, they want to do this, and then they have a change of heart, say, well, maybe I ought to rethink that, which doesn't seem to me to be an unreasonable thing. I don't know why there should be an ironclad law to that degree, where if you change your mind, now you incur additional expenses and so forth. And this seems to be, how prevalent is this among your group?
I think there's, like, it basically goes back to, I think it all goes back to, like, how you're raised. I come from a, like, my parents are, like, strong, like, political background. They're always involved in it. And, you know, it rubbed off into me, and, like, I've always had a passion for it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I just thought, like, at times, like, you know, if you study certain majors, like, what, you know, if you study, like, politics or political science, it's, like, there really isn't no money on it, I guess, in a way, unless you're trying to, you know, have a way, like, to basically, like, sell yourself in a way. So I took into, like, engineering because I was always, like, good at math and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized, you know, yeah, I mean, you can get the construction contracts and things like that, but it offers nothing on social change. Everything's about time, money, and profits, you know. that really doesn't offer anything to the situation. And I don't know, I was just, when you were talking about the people who seem inept, like Obama and the people you appoint, yeah, I think you got to trace it back to the point of college education and how it's really slowing down the American people, and, you know, only some people benefit from this, you know.
Well, thank you so much for your call today, and best wishes. I hope that you get your situation resolved, but I think you have such a strong sense of obligation to the community. You ought to be commended for that. But it is also sad that a person with your potential and with your passion for what it is you want to do, you find yourself stymied by this situation, which basically is about money. And your drive to achieve is now being tested by, you know, the cost of it. That's too sad. But thank you so much for your call today, Lewis. And
thank you.
And best of
luck. Thanks for all the points you bring up.
It's really nice to hear your show. Thank you so much. And it's great to have people like you contribute to it. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice.
Hello.
How are you today?
Fine, thank you. And how are you?
Good. I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking. And hello to all the your listeners there out there. Real good show today. I've been enjoying this.
Thank you.
The middle portion of it should have been called Harvey Knows. Because Harvey was spectacular. And he hit it right on the head, and he filled in all
the blanks. I think you're confusing Harvey with Joel.
Oh, Joel. I'm sorry.
Yes, Joel.
Yeah, he, this is something that I tell people in the black community all the time, is that this man was put there for this reason, to carry out this agenda. And he was absolutely correct that Bush couldn't have got away with this, Kerry or McCain. None of them could have gotten away with it. And this was their plan the whole time, is to carry out this war on indigenous people and black people and brown people around the world. So, yeah, Joel hit it right on the head. So, and by the way, I don't get very far with that analysis in the black community either, as you can probably imagine. So what I wanted to do today was just talk about the weekend, and I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend and unwind, and part of unwinding should be a little bit of laughter because there's so much going on in the world. So there's a movie that I would like people to check out, and you can look it up online. It's called Idiocracy. Some of you may have heard of it already. It's a comedy, but it's kind of tragic as well. Without giving away the whole movie, it stars Luke Wilson.
Oh, is this for the guys who made Beavis and Butthead the same movie? Okay.
Yeah, Luke Wilson and Maya Rudolph.
Does that give you a clue?
Okay. But it's kind of sad, too, in a way, because the plot, without giving away the whole thing, is that Luke Wilson and Maya Rudolph play these two very average kind of people. She plays a prostitute, a street prostitute. He plays a army private, just the average army private, normal guy. And they agree to, they're kind of coerced into participating in a army government experiment for freezing your body, cryostasis or whatever. For a year was supposed to be the plan. Something goes wrong, and they wake up in the year 2505. And they call it Idiocracy because the public has been dumbed down so much that they can barely even function. And the part that kind of reminded me of this today was about, Terry Crews plays the president of what is then the United States, and they call him the President of America. So he has all these cabinet members. I'm not going to give away too much, but they're very, very dumb, like everyone else in the population is. They can't solve any of the problems in the world. And he gives all these dumb excuses for why these people have these jobs in his cabinet. And that's the part that relates to what we're talking about today. The thing is, this takes place supposedly 500 years in the future, but I think Idiocracy is way closer than that. If we don't turn some of this stuff around, I think it's going to become an Idiocracy in the next 50 years, maybe.
What is your reaction to this? This most recent move by the president to appoint the Ebola czar, who has basically been running campaigns, Ron Klain, and who basically coached him, Obama was then senator from Illinois, in a debate against John McCain, and that was supposed to be the big tie that binds. I mean, it is so wrong on so many levels.
Yeah, I see this whole thing here as just a continuation of the old crony capitalism that's been around forever, that got worse under George W. Bush. And if you look at it, this president here has been, everything Bush has done, he's pretty much taken it to 2.0. Mm-hmm. He's dialed it up, made it worse, most everything, I will say. And I see this as that crony capitalism. You scratch my back and I scratch yours. He helped him get elected, obviously, in whatever way. So you scratch my back, I scratch yours. You remember when we were talking months ago about the health care bill that was a bill at the time, became
right.
law. And when it became law, who got the contract to do the website for you know? Remember we were talking about that?
Yes,
Michelle Obama's college friend's
mm-hmm.
company. So this is that friends and other connections in the business, they get, you know, it's 2.0 of that crony capitalism thing. And it's only going to get worse. Mm-hmm. It's only going to get worse.
I want to ask you, out there in Los Angeles, how is Los Angeles faring with the water crisis?
Well, you know, the state has been in drought for months and months. I see people out here just carrying on with their normal lives. Nobody acts as if we're in any kind of a water crisis. I try to be mindful on my end of it. I don't water my lawn too much. I don't leave the shower running and stuff like that. I mean, I try to be mindful, but I don't see other people doing anything different that I know anyway. Mm-hmm. And even I will say, even the state buildings that I pass by and county buildings and things like that, they're not even conserving anything. So nobody's acting like there's a crisis at all. And you know, as you know, the western states, not just California, most of the western states are in this situation as well.
Well, they will feel it because there's going to be an incredible cost increase for food and things like that very soon. I imagine
it's
going to go up quite a bit. Well, thank you, DX, for your call today. And you're promoting Idiocracy.
That's right.
Okay.
People should watch that movie. I don't know if you've seen it, Yatrice.
No, I haven't.
Not only will it make you laugh like crazy, but it also will give you some insight into the dumbing down and propaganda that's going on and where it might lead if we don't mm-hmm. have more shows like yours to educate people.
Hours,
yes. And it was good to hear the young guy call right before me. I loved that. That's
I
wonderful.
Loved it, too. I hope that he will become a regular caller.
Exactly.
And, you know, the thing is so sad that on so many levels, they haven't figured out some basic things. Like today, I was reading about these schools, you know, that they're complaining about the public schools and the deterioration of the public schools. What normal country would in this day and age still predicate taxes on the basis, school budgets on the basis of taxes, mm-hmm. residential taxes,
mm-hmm.
or property taxes. It is so wrong because obviously what you're saying is if you happen to live in a poor community which will not generate nearly as much in the way of property taxes as a wealthy community. The accident of geography just consigns you to total and complete inferiority. And the fact that this continues means that there's no incentive at all to change it. Why must the school budget be predicated on property taxes? This is wrong.
Absolutely. And you treat this is something I've been thinking about the last couple of days, and I think it's also by design because
think
about it. I mean, in the poor communities, you have the underclass, of course, and they're the ones who you want to starve of an education because an education brings you out of that class and maybe into the middle class. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So to base funding for schools on property taxes makes perfect sense to the elite because they don't want people who have been downtrodden and mistreated all their lives in the underclass to be running anything, not corporations, not the government. So you got to screen those people, keep those people at bay. So how do you do it? The best way is to attack them at the education level, and that's exactly what that is. You know, I've thought about that for years. Why hasn't that changed? Why isn't that? Is it that way? And that's the only explanation I can have for it is that it's by design.
It is
because
by design.
The elite people who run this country don't want anybody, an outsider, quote unquote, coming in and making any changes or trying to. And that's how you stop them. And you know, that's my analysis. And you know, it's funny you should say that because recently I heard an interview. God, I can't think of the man's name now. It's a very interesting interview. Oh, my God, I'm going to have to call back and let you know. Maybe I'll email it to you, but it's very interesting about this very subject. And he broke it down, I mean, from, like, way back into the 1800s, how this was all constructed, you know.
And you see how unwilling people are to just see the light of day. It should be a sign of progress that people have come to conclusions. There are enough statistics and enough figures and numbers to persuade people that it is no longer plausible if we want an education that is available to everybody, which is what the concept of public education should be, then why are we still continuing this crazy formula? It ought to stop. But, you know, this is how it works. Thank you so much, DX, for your call today.
Thank you. You have a safe trip back now.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed coming here. I still am enjoying it. Thank you so much. Now, that brings us to the end of our program today. But I need to kind of prepare you for next week. Next week, and I'll tell you one of the reasons I'm here, is I want to really rev up the support for PRN. I really want us as activists and people who appreciate alternative points of view to get excited about supporting a station dedicated simply to that premise. PRN has been doing this work now for more than 12 years, and it is time for us to take charge of the avenues of information that are suited to our needs. So all week next week, I'm going to start off with Monday. Gary and I are going to be partnering in doing some fundraising. And Gary, I have to say a word or two about him. I've known Gary for more than 20 years. And in all of that time, his concern has always been about getting information to people so that it can improve and better their lives. In my association with Gary on WBAI, which is where I met him, it has always been about that. He's always been very helping, very helpful, very supportive. And this is a time for us to step forward and support him. And in supporting him, we support ourselves because PRN is available to all of us. And in one capacity or the other, it serves a great need. So next week, we will consider it. He didn't ask me to do it. In fact, I asked him. I had to persuade him to let's do this. He was reluctant. But we have to do it. We have to do it. As they say, freedom isn't free. So we do this, and it's not an exorbitant and overburdening thing to do. It should be with great delight and with great joy. So I want us to be very joyful next week as we embark. We'll do our programming, for sure, but we will also joyfully safeguard this avenue of information. It's very, very, very important. I also will be talking at various community groups while I'm here. Newark is next, and I'll be doing a talk about reclaiming the community, rebuilding the community, and absolutely rebounding. And this is the work that must be done, especially in African American and Latino communities that are under assault. And when I say communities, I don't just mean the houses and the buildings in the communities. I mean the human structures, including and especially the families that have to be reconstructed and reconstituted if we are going to have any progress. And this has to be an awareness. This has to be a mandate in all communities that are under assault. And we have to fight back, because we see, and the reason I've been concentrating so much on Detroit is that it is a template for what is to come all across the country. It is happening all across the country. It is no exaggeration that Detroit, in the state of Michigan, is the first and the major, it is a historic event in terms of bankruptcies, the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. But every single African-American community, pretty much, is under emergency management right now in the state of Michigan. What does that mean? It means that they are systematically targeted for emptying. They're going to empty these communities. We saw it in Harlem. It's going on. I drove through Harlem by bus. I'm looking and I'm saying, my God, what has happened here? In Bedford-Stuyvesant and in other communities, we're seeing that process occurring. So we have to stand up and fight. And we have to be conscious about it. So that's one of the things that I'm going to be stressing. But as of Monday, we'll do our regular programming. But I want you to prepare yourself. Along with that, I'm going to ask you to commit yourselves to supporting PRN and getting the word out. We have to build our audience, which is important. But we also have to support the cost, to help defray the cost of operating this station. I wasn't asked to do this. Gary didn't put me here to make that plea. I am making that plea of my own accord, because I know what it means to run an institution. It takes money. There are expenses to be met. And a lot of this, in fact, if not all of it, is coming out of Gary's pockets. And it's time for us to step up as partners in this event and say, I'm doing my fair share. It's not going to overburden you. We're not asking you to be sacrificial about it, but we are asking you to become conscious of your obligation, if you will, an obligation to support this medium because it supports you. So please think about that. As of Monday, I want to introduce the joy of giving when so much is given. Okay? So we'll do that on Monday. I want to thank you, as I always do, for the pleasure and the privilege of your company. I really and sincerely mean that. This program is the sum total of everybody's contribution. I get great reviews, but I always remind people, you know, this isn't my program. I'm the traffic cop, yes. But I am delighted to be among the contributors of this program. And it is the end result of everybody's input, everybody having something to say and some kind of flavor they bring to the soup. So I am so grateful about that. The audience is highly motivated to offer their best every time, and so the program has a high level of functioning. I love that. So you do me great honor, and I, in turn, have to do you the favor of being prepared as the host to do this program and to keep it at that level that, that does justice to your intelligence. I come to the end of the program today with sincerest thanks for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Have yourselves a great weekend, and we will see each other on Monday, joyfully going about our business. Thank you so much.